Thank you. I'm Blair, compulsive overeater, and thanks for asking me to share my story. I wanted to open with something I've heard other people do. It's a set-aside prayer. God, please help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my recovery for a brand new experience. Please show me your truth. And I'd like to also open with a favorite quote, which is, "Speak the truth, even if your voice shakes." And my voice is shaking a bit because I'm really scared. I haven't done this for a while. And I started trying to make notes, and someone early on, as I got on the meeting, said, "You know, the more I try to prepare for this, the harder it becomes." And I started thinking, I think my favorite format is to share in meetings and not prepare what I'm going to say, just see what inspires me. So I've tried to just think along general lines and see what occurs. The first thing that occurs is a reading from Voices of Recovery the other day, where it talked about why we're in meetings and what we do and hoping to be of help to other fellows. And maybe also people outside the room, the rooms. And so today I wanted to talk about my experience first. And I think a lot of us started out with this early. I started out with it. I think I do have a physical disease. My body seems to process foods in a different way. And I was a large child. And my appetite seemed really outsized compared to other children who seemed thinner, you know, more delicate. I was this hardy, stocky, big, tall child. And I think at age 4, that became unacceptable to a parent and who started taking measures, steps to have me not be a large child. And it took the form of, at age 4, restricting foods that I could eat versus what other kids could eat. It took the form of liquid meal supplements like Metrical, SeGO, various things like that. And it was a constant reminder of how different I was. And the way I found relief from it, the older I got, the more I would go to other people's houses, friends' houses. And their moms would give us great food and treats and all the things that I loved. And I didn't have to sneak it, which is what I did at home. And the older I got and the more reinforcement on how unacceptable that was, it was not just it was not just at home. It was at school. It was Brownie Scout meetings. It was, you know, just various people saying you're ugly, you're fat, you're stupid, whatever. And my maiden name, Ramon, is rhymes with a word for fat, and so that was a favorite nickname of people's. And so I experienced a lot of stress, and my response was to come home, and if the house was empty, nobody else was home, it was a great cue to fix a lot of food, retreat in front of a TV or with a book. And reading and food became very much my comfort, my friend, my safe place. I think a lot of us have experienced this. And I resonated so much when I first came in and hearing that and feeling like I wasn't alone. So fast forward to fifth grade, I was put on diet pills. It was considered at that time a good idea for a weight loss solution. And if you can imagine a hyperactive fifth grader, that was not a great picture. I was also still overeating. And I think matters reached a head in sixth grade when my mother announced, "You're not going to get any fatter." And that became the mandate. So diet pills, exercise restricting, I became thin. in the seventh grade. And I thought everything was done. I remember my gym teacher putting me in front of the class, putting me on a scale and congratulating me, and then comparing me to my very overweight friend, who she said, "Maybe you can take a lesson from this, Marianne." And I felt so ashamed and so bad for her. And so, we'd all love to say, "That's the end of my story. That's everything worked out great, happy ending, end of the story." It was just another part of the journey. And what I did from teenage years on into adulthood was pretty much repetition. It was a way and pay program. It was self-help books. It was diet after diet. It was over-exercising, restricting, gaining the weight, trying to lose it again. And I found theater when I was a teenager. So trying to be thin was a thing. And I also found pot and alcohol and food. So I was pretty much of a hot mess during high school. Studies weren't really a thing, but feeling accepted was. So on into college, still with theater and really getting serious about it as a profession, to the point where I left college at age 19 and moved to New York and decided to continue my studies. And my parents were sort of like, "You do this and you do it on your own." So I was working, studying, auditioning. And the awareness was that being thin was absolutely something I had to do. So I'd walk all over the place, exercise like crazy, and eat one meal a day. And that was my answer for a while. And I love New York. I mean, wasn't loving the focus on weight, but I loved being there. It was like the high school experience I didn't have. So back to what I found at age 24, I realized that I wasn't going to make it in theater the way I hoped to. I wasn't going to get the approval and the admiration, all the reasons, the motives that I really went into it. So I moved back to North Carolina, where I was born, and went back to school. And the struggle with weight never stopped. But after I married and got pregnant, I went up to 270 pounds, which is scary for a pregnant person. Unfortunately, had no complications, but I started understanding I didn't want to pass this along to my child, this disease. And I started seeing it as a disease, sort of, and went to OA in my ninth month of pregnancy and thought maybe I'd found something. A year later, I decided it was a diet club. I didn't hear Steps or really Big Book or any of that so much because I wasn't really open to it. So I left. And what became for me the answer was more of the same, more diets, doctors, shots, acupuncture, hypnosis, and then a medical weight loss clinic where I had babysitters and my husband stay with my child so I could go for a month to be at a medical weight loss clinic at a famous medical university that offered this. I would go to the classes and all the everything every day with everyone. Then I would come back to the room I was running and binge. And I think it's a graphic example of how much this disease impacts us. There was no logical way for me to find my way out of it. And I'd lose a little weight. And eventually, my weight, by the time I was 40, got up to 300 pounds. Sorry, when I was 35, I became 300 pounds. And I stayed at that weight for 10 years. And I have pictures, and I was going to have someone put them up. And I think enough people have been at that weight and have seen others at that weight and what that's like. Trying to dress so that it didn't look like I weighed 300 pounds. And you wear a lot of black. You do everything you can. You spend a lot on makeup and try to be the funniest person in the room and do all these things to feel accepted at 300 pounds. And what I found was I was throwing everybody under the bus that mattered to me because I was so obsessed with my weight. I was so sure that the next diet, the next whatever, was going to relieve me of this curse. And then finally, I decided to have weight loss surgery. I can't recommend it nor disparage it. It's what I did. And I can say definitively, it did not hit a reset button for me.
That's 10 minutes, Blair.
Thank you, Judy. It didn't hit a reset button for me. I did go down to 150 pounds and then began slowly gaining back a little at a time. And also, I couldn't eat as much, so I found alcohol. And I had pretty much set aside alcohol as a binge thing in my 20s and 30s, and certainly wasn't drinking when I was pregnant. But after the weight loss surgery, I was drinking a huge amount and finally found my way to AA. And that's where I began to understand about addiction. Food was still not on my radar. I thought it was a self-discipline issue and that I had another diet in me. I could do keto, I could do any number of things, but it was not the addiction that sounded like an excuse. I could accept alcohol. When I put down the alcohol and got sober, I picked food back up again, and it was this constant back and forth up to 200, back to 160, and so forth and so on. I don't think I need to belabor it. And then I found through, I was 12-stepped into OA again, this time by an AA friend who had stayed abstinent for 25 years. And I loved her and respected her so much. I thought, okay, I'll try this. But my step one moment was in the kitchen, pulling out non-keto foods and thinking I'll have a last binge. And I looked at all the OA literature and I looked at the meeting schedules. And I finally went, this is insane. And I think the next day I really started in OA for in earnest. And that was OA start for me in October of 2019. So I've been here a little over 5 years. And what I've gotten since then is this growth. And I'd love to say that my initial experience is what I've taken through the whole time. I'm a slow learner. And for me, it's been about keeping a beginner's mind every day, more and more, it's every day. I started out strict abstinence, recognizing my alcoholic foods right away. And they're still my alcoholic foods. And I'm not sure if I can name all the ones. I'd be happy to share it with you privately if you want to know. But I stayed off of those, got off of my behaviors, and I thought I was a poster child for OA. I would literally go on meetings and tell people, and I'd go on chat rooms and say, this is how you stay abstinent, which makes me laugh. I mean, and then I was with a sponsor who said, I think you've gotten really thin and I think you need to go on maintenance. Only she didn't want to explain that, and I didn't understand. I didn't take back alcoholic foods. I just started increasing portions and snacking and thinking, I don't need to measure foods. I've done that on my way in pay. But that's when I started really working the steps and really paying attention to what all of you all were saying. And that was for me maybe maybe my program has been a series of resets where I'll start thinking my way is the right way. I can't do this because my experience showed me so much pain and I have to live in that pain. Or I don't agree with what that person says and I'm not going to try it. Excuse me, my mouth's a little dry. But here's what I am learning then, and I continue to learn. This is a disease, and I've lived it emotionally. I took a lot of victimhood and I stayed with it. I've lived with resentments and stayed with those. I've finally started coming to see a higher power that I thought I had picked up very easily in childhood. And really, I've had a reset with all of these things. The fourth step was for me a big reset, where I started understanding what my part was in these resentments and seeing how I had led with the same things I resented in other people and still do. I still have to recognize that. And I'd say that as trying to do service, for me, it started out being moderating and then it became sponsorship.
5 minutes, Blair.
Thanks, Judy. I think I've had to understand how perfect I'm not. I used to come on meetings and think I've got to have the perfect share, and I'd write it out and I'd rehearse it. And if I made you laugh and I made you think, and I got a lot of messages in the chat, oh, that was great, or got a lot of feedback calls or something. And I had to have a reset on that. I'm really not. And I joke around and say, I've got a halo. Oops, look, it's slipping. And I don't. The things I rely on are just living in for today, because I see new stuff about it's the set aside prayer. It's what I see every day in this program, in you all, and what I hear intuition wise. I work with a sponsor and we're working slowly through the steps. For me, it's like I think my third or fourth time doing it, and I think I'll probably be doing it in some way, shape, or form all my life. And I come to a meeting almost every day and I make outreach calls. And I sponsor one person now. I'd say sponsorship has turned into a whole different thing for me. I try to lead by example only. Mainly for me, it's walking with someone. If I have experience that might help, that's what I strive for, not to show somebody how to do this perfectly. I started weighing and measuring food. I'm abstinent after a big reset from a speaker I heard on a meeting on July the 4th, Freedom Day. Oh my God. That's been 4 months ago. And I thought I was abstinent all that time. I think I just had a different definition. And now I understand that there is more. There's more in all of this recovery that I hadn't realized. And maybe the things I want to sum up are, again, it's for today. Again, it's about accepting an open mind and being open to what other people's experiences. For me, it's also about using an OA app, and that has all the prayers. And every day I try to get centered with those things, particularly on the big book reading, which is, I think, on pages 86 and 87, called On Awakening. And those give me my instructions for how to proceed physically, emotionally, and spiritually. It's my big way of connecting with God. I also meditate most days, and I try to get in some kind of exercise because walking and listening to podcasts and outreach calls while I'm walking. I'm huffing and puffing, but connecting in some way, shape, or form. You know, thanks for listening. It's scary to do this because I haven't really tried to entertain anybody today, and that used to be my real MO. But I'm glad to be here and glad to speak my truth, even though my voice is shaking and my mouth got dry. So thank you all so much. And I even have 30 seconds. I usually go to the end and beyond, but I'll leave it there and look forward to hearing your own experience, strength, and hope. Thank you.